I'm Will Leach, and this is the People Still Read Books podcast episode. You know, I honestly don't even remember. This is the sporadic, occasional, every once in a while. We're supposed to have Dave Parker, the former baseball player, in his book Cobra, which is very good, by the way, and you should buy. He was supposed to be on, but we had some connection issues, and I had some recording issues. It just didn't really work out. But buy his book. It's great. Before you do that, buy my book, by the way. My book, How Lucky, comes out on May 11th, and it's getting close now. And lots of stuff's happening. Keep an eye out on the internets for more news and excitement. But remind you, as always, to follow us at People Still Read Books. Email me, peoplestillreadbooks@gmail.com. Our guest today is Luke Eplin. Luke Eplin is the author of a really awesome book about the 1948 Cleveland Indians called Our Team, the epic story of four men in the World Series that changed baseball. We actually share an editor. The editor of How Lucky is the same editor of this book, which is, I'd heard about this book, but that's what got me to actually read it. And it's terrific. It's a really excellent book. It basically tells the story of four kind of major figures in the history of baseball: Larry Doby, Bill Veeck, Bob Feller, and Satchel Paige. They all kind of converge on the last Cleveland team to have won a World Series. This is a really smart, well-written, fun book that's fascinating in many ways. And so you should get it. It's out. It's very good. You should pre-order my book first, of course. How Lucky, wherever you order books. But on the whole, this is an awesome book. And you should listen to me talk to Luke Eplin, author of Our Team. Hello. And I'm now talking to Luke. Luke, I forgot to tell you when we were discussing beforehand, I've already done your intro, so I don't have to do that now. I've pre-recorded it. I made you sound awesome, but you're about to make yourself sound even more awesome. So thank you for talking to me about your book, Our Team, the Epic Story of Four Men in the World Series that Changed Baseball. How are you, sir?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
So I love this book for many, many reasons. It hits right my strike zone. Obviously, it's about baseball, and I love baseball. And I tend to be like a big fan of baseball. Like, I totally really like it. And so that's a strike zone there. But it really, you know, it is the journalist in me, and I know that you are obviously a very skilled journalist as well. There's nothing I love more than like, hey, you know what? That story that you've only kind – like, you know, like the vague outlines of, and you know, like the little trivia question about, but you haven't actually really explored to find out what it was really like and what really happened. That's what I love about this book, about a team that I knew was a big deal, the 1948 Cleveland Indians, but had never really delved deep into, like, this last time they've won the World Series. It's like they had Bob Feller and Satchel Paige and all this stuff, but I never really like looked it deep into. And it is a fascinating book about something that, frankly, I'm just happy for you that you did this before somebody else did, because it's such a great story. And I'm curious, what initially inspired you? Did you just see this and be like, oh, this is mine before someone else can do it? Or what kind of inspired you to delve so deep and tell this kind of incredible story?
Well, thanks, Will. Not at all. I did not start with saying to myself, I better do this before someone else does. I came about it through a very roundabout way. I'm from Southern Illinois, a small town down there. My grandfather, during the World War II, worked in St. Louis. He was slightly deaf, and so he was 4F. He worked at an airplane factory in St. Louis. He used to hop streetcars after his wartime shifts and go to Sportsman's Park. He was one of those weird St. Louis fans that was a fan of the St. Louis Browns and not the St. Louis Cardinals. So I used to grow up hearing stories of the St. Louis Browns. And of course, anybody that hears stories of the St. Louis Browns is eventually going to hear a story about Bill Veeck, who was the last owner of the St. Louis Browns. It's where he did a lot of the stunts that became sort of the most notorious ones, the ones that we really remember Bill Veeck for, most notably taking Eddie Goodell, a little person, to the plate. And so the original intention of the book was to write about the Browns. I wanted to sort of honor my grandpa, honor the place where I came from, and sort of see if I could tell a fresh story about the Browns. But when I was doing my research for the book, I went back to Bill Veeck's earlier tenure of the Indians. He was first the owner of the Indians before he was the owner of the Browns. If you go to the NYPL, the New York Public Library, they have sort of bound copies of the Sporting News, the great baseball journal of the time, that you can sort of flip through like a novel. And so I read 1946, 1947, 1948, which was kind of Bill Veeck's tenure there, and sort of just read it like a novel. And I kept seeing these sort of four names bubbling to the surface: Larry Doby, Satchel Paige, Bob Feller, Bill Veeck. And I was thinking to myself that the story is really here. Like, this is an integration story that I think I didn't know about. And I'm a huge baseball fan too. And it was something that was kind of new to me. And through these four figures, you could tell it in such a way that perhaps hasn't really been framed, through two white men and two black men that each sort of represent a different facet of the integration experience that was happening at the time. And so that was really my pathway into it. And it wasn't until I was just really researching it that I was like, oh my gosh, this story is awesome. I'm so excited to be doing this.
Yeah, it feels like it should be like the every single time we talk about Cleveland Indians, soon to be the Cleveland baseball team, soon to be the Cleveland, whatever they end up being called. It feels like this should be like the central, like the way that we think of Babe Ruth when we think of the Yankees, or the thing we think of Stan Musial when we think of the Cardinals, or sadness and failure when we think of the Chicago Cubs. It feels like this should be the story that immediately this book should be like leading off the Cleveland team's bookstore. Like, it feels like it should be everywhere. And I'm curious, why do you think — I want to get into some details of the story, but I'm curious, when you obviously Jackie Robinson and mm-hmm. the contrast of Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby a little bit, but like, there's like, these are like Bob Feller and Bob and Bill Veeck and Satchel Paige and Larry Doby are not like minor names. Like, a lot of major baseball people know these people for various reasons. But the fact they all converge on this team, that's also the last one, the last Cleveland team that won the World Series. I'm curious, like, that's why I kind of said, like, were you just happy that you elbowed this out before someone else got it? Because it's such a fascinating story. And I'm curious, and do you have any thoughts just kind of from your research of why this hasn't been like — this isn't like the 30th book that's come back about this team? Because it really, I feel so like kind of grit happy for you that like you got to take this story, because it's such a good one.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I do think that in some ways the narrative was lost. And I think the way that I told this book was to kind of put the reader right in the middle of it, almost, to not sort of just like jump ahead or jump behind or anything like that, but to sort of like retell it as though it were happening at the time, just to sort of give a sense of like how exciting this thing was and how this narrative is both sort of storybook and probable, the whole sort of nine yards there. I think in terms of why it's been lost, I mean, you can sort of look at various strands if you start pulling at them. Bob Feller was in his time right up there with Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams in terms of the most popular athletes. And perhaps before the war, he was exceeding them. And his star has fallen quite a bit for certain comments that he made toward the latter half of his life. Certain sort of comments he did about integration and things like that, that have caused his star to fall. Larry Doby, unfortunately, kind of became a footnote, as you said, to Jackie Robinson. And the sort of Robinson story of breaking into the majors has become — it sort of doubles as the story of integration in baseball and eclipses all the other sort of narratives that were happening at the same time. And one of the sort of things that this book is trying to do is to show that like it's equally as meaningful, the Larry Doby story. And at the time in 1948, people thought, whenever the Indians won the World Series, that Larry Doby was going to be the one that was kind of going to eclipse Jackie Robinson. I mean, his potential was that great to be like that. Bill Veeck, becomes the owner of the Browns, does some of the more notorious stunts, and we kind of start to think of him as more like a P.T. Barnum-like figure rather than the sort of pioneer that he is. In some ways, I think his Cleveland story is undertold, and whenever we think about Bill Veeck, because he becomes a sort of larger-than-life figure as he leaves. And there's just so many other sort of factors, and one of them being the fact that it happened in Cleveland and not in New York, things like that. And so really the sort of thing I really wanted to do is just recapture the narrative here. And I hope I did it.
You did. Good work. It's yours. If I see someone else talk, if I say anyone even so much and say the names of any of these people, I will tell them no, that is Luke's story.
Yes,
please stay away. Yeah. I actually, one of the things I think that really comes across kind of fascinating in the book is obviously Larry Doby. Not only is Larry Doby's story different than Jackie Robinson's, but like the strategy that Bill Veeck used to kind of get him in the majors is very different than what Branch Rickey did with Jackie Robinson. And I don't know If it was, I'm curious your thought, having written about this and researched it, do you think, can you explain what it is and do you think it was the correct one?
So Bilvec believed that the sort of long drawn out process that Jackie Robinson had from the time that the Brooklyn Dodgers organization signed him, which was in October of 1945, to the time that he actually debuted on the Dodgers, which was in April of 1947, put quite a lot of pressure on Jackie Robinson, because for 18 months he was under the spotlight. Robinson went for a year in the minor leagues with the Montreal Royals, where he had quite an impressive minor league season down there, where he led his team to the Little World Series championship. But he felt that sort of drawn out process actually was detrimental to Robinson. It would be just sort of better if integration happened all at once, almost like ripping off a Band-Aid. Vec believed that Brooklyn was the sort of right place for what they called the great experiment of integration to take place. It was a multi-ethnic sort of borough. He felt that the fans there would be great. Would be good to have it. So he waited for Robinson to debut. But then he was telling sort of black sports writers at the time, most notably Wendell Smith, that Cleveland was going to follow soon thereafter if the results in Brooklyn were promising. But you shouldn't expect him to do what Branch Rickey did with Robinson. He told a reporter that one of these days, when the Indians go onto the field, there will be a black player among them. And that was basically his strategy. He signed Larry Doby in early July of 1947. Larry Doby played one final game with the Newark Eagles, which was a Negro League team that he was on the 4th of July, 1947. Doby boarded a train in Newark, bound for Chicago, where the Indians were playing the White Sox. And the very next day, Doby was on the Indians. He journeyed literally overnight from the Negro Leagues to the Major Leagues. No 18-month buildup, no nothing. It was just kind of like throwing him into the fire. And Doby really struggled. Doby said that the first 10 times or so he came to bat on the Indians, his teeth were chattering. He was kind of in a state of shock. And the clubhouse, the Indians clubhouse, was very cold to him, if not hostile. The players themselves had not been prepped for this. They found out about integration just at around the same time Doby did. It wasn't like Vec was saying this to them for months, building it up and some stuff like that. So it was something they were going through at the same time Doby was as well. So he had a really tough 1947 season. And toward the end, Bill Vec himself admitted that perhaps Branch Rickey had been right to give Robinson sort of time to acclimate and that his strategy was not as sound.
Which is, to me, one of the things, so many things that work out so wonderfully with 1948. I mean, like, I think even Roger Hornsby had said that, like, that Doby, if he were white, wouldn't even be in the majors after 47. Yeah. And, like, he was really just kind of, like, lambasted. And then 48 happens, and he's not only a star, but he's key to everything that they're doing. And, you know, you kind of tell the story of all four of these guys, even just before they kind of came to Cleveland. But what was the view going into that year? Was there a sense that this was going to be a special season, or was it just the start of just kind of a crazy ride that they kind of just tried to kind of stay on the horse the entire way?
There was not a sense at all that this was going to be the Indian special season. Even writers in Cleveland at the start of 1948 were picking the Indians to come in third behind the Yankees and the Red Sox. There was a sense that the Indians were very shallow in the outfield and that their pitching staff was thin beyond sort of Feller. Larry Doby himself, there was all the expectations among everybody, even among Bill Vec, that Larry Doby was not going to make the team, that he had such a sort of tough year in 1947 that he needed sort of seasoning in the minor leagues. And Vec was doing everything he could to add outfield and pitching help, and he just was so limited in what he could do with trades and whatnot. So the Indians' weaknesses were everywhere. They had no idea that a player like Bob Lemon, who had been a sort of infielder outfielder just 2 years earlier, was going to burst out of nowhere and win 20 games. They had no idea that someone like Gene Bearden, who was this knuckleballer who'd been sort of severely injured during the war, that Vec had traded for just kind of as a throw-in, was also going to burst out of nowhere and win 20 games. And of course, they had no idea that Larry Doby was not only going to make the team after sort of an improbable spring training, but that he was going to become the exact outfielder that Vec was looking for toward the end of the season, even though Doby himself had never played outfield until that point. He was a second baseman, but he just kind of learns it on the fly and has this really storybook season in 1948. In fact, the entire year for the Indians that year was storybook.
So when you're kind of following this season long, did you have any thoughts about the 1948 Cleveland Indians before you started this project? I mean, like I'm curious. Like obviously you were a Cardinals fan, like all good-hearted, right-minded people.
Yeah.
But certainly, you know, how did you find yourself as you kind of digging through the old copies of the Sporting News? It had to just feel like almost unbelievable, the number of things that were all compiling on itself. I mean, there's a playoff game at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Just to find the American League Championship.
It just seems almost absurd, the number of things that all kind of came together this one year. And I think kind of going in fresh helped me out a lot. I mean, I know that everybody sort of thinks that I started out with sort of the 1948 Indians and then worked backwards into finding these four people, but I didn't. I found the four people first: Vec, Feller, Page, Doby. And then I sort of built my way into the 1948 Indians. And as I was researching the team, I remember having to sort of stop myself sometimes and just be like, this can't be real, the way that the sort of symmetry between these four people is playing out, the sort of extraordinary excitement of this season as it plays out, all the factors that you have together. I really felt like this could be the greatest baseball story not yet really sort of fully fleshed out. I know that sounds arrogant, but like, I'm not saying that I was able to write it like that, but I was like, man, imagine what happened if like David Halberstam did this book. Like, it would be incredible. There's so many amazing facets to this story. And so as I was researching it, I was just growing more and more excited.
And how old is Satchel Paige this season?
He's 42 years old.
42 years old.
Whenever Bill Vec signs him, and Bill Vec signs him midway through the 1948 season. Of course, you know, Satchel Paige, sort of not knowing what his age is, became sort of a media phenomenon. Some people thought that he was in his 50s whenever he signed, but we know pretty well that he was 42. And Vec really signs him in 1948 because the pitching staff is struggling a lot, mainly because Bob Feller, who was the ace of the Indians pitching staff for so long, is having an uncharacteristically poor season. He's under 500 whenever Vec signs Paige.
And I think Feller, I think there's a, because, you know, Doby's story is so compelling and Bill Vec is such a character and Satchel Paige is such a character. There's something about Feller who I think, as you kind of touched on, had some, you know, perhaps moments where you might wish he would be, so we'll call them shilling moments, perhaps later in his career, where you want to just enjoy the baseball player and you realize that you can't. But I think you kind of can make a compelling case for Feller to almost being even a little ahead of his time as well, at least when it comes to the financial side of baseball.
Yeah, Feller is one of the more entrepreneurial athletes around. He's like that from a very early age. He comes from a farm in Iowa. He has this extraordinary ability from a very young age. His father clears out a part of their pasture, builds him sort of a baseball diamond there. It's kind of like the original Field of Dreams. And then Feller sort of makes it into the majors at age 17 as a junior and starts setting records immediately. He ties the major league mark for strikeouts in a game and only his fifth ever start. He is a sensation. I mean, there's just no other way around it. And the fact that he comes from a farm, from a place that didn't have sort of electricity or running water, and sort of people like to sort of think of him as this sort of all-American boy who sort of lives by these all-American values, in some ways obscured the fact that Feller was also a sort of capitalist at heart. One of the first things that he does whenever he's 17 is hire an agent and becomes this sort of person that makes money off of his own likeness and particularly his own narrative. He knew exactly how to spin that narrative. And so he is he's barnstorming with Satchel Paige when he's only a teenager. And he's also the first athlete ever to incorporate himself. He's doing these crazy barnstorming tours that go across the country and making more money than any professional athlete has ever made off of them. He's somebody who's really sort of ahead of the time when it comes to like branding himself.
And so it all culminates, all comes together at this time, and it, you go into this World Series and obviously everything that comes with it. And I'm curious, what was the reaction Like, did everyone at the time realize, even before they win the World Series, that there's, like, this is something special? Like, were they covered that way, or were they covered as all these stories are kind of coming together, and at the end of the year, you're like, oh, wow, they won the World Series. That's really historic. Like I always think of that horrible, terrible thing that happened in 2016 that ruined much of life on the planet for the next 4 or 5 years, which is, of course, the Cubs winning the World Series. Mm-hmm. And you look at that team at the beginning of that year. Like, that, people were talking about the Cubs all year. Like, clearly that was the team that in 16, like, they were the exciting team. It was kind of like the Cubs version of the Super Bowl shuffle team for the Bears. It's the one you're watching all the way through. Was that the case in Cleveland? Was that was the team covered like that all year? Did everyone realize that, oh, wow, the personalities are happening and covered accordingly, or did they just kind of sneak up on everybody?
There were two sorts of reactions in Cleveland. One was that the Cleveland fans were refusing to sort of believe what was before their eyes. The Indians got off to a tremendous start in 1948. They held in first throughout much of the first half, but the fans were just booing the team mercilessly. Anytime that sort of an error happened or sort of a mistake on the field, there was so much boos. And it was because the Indians had sort of teased the fans so much before. The Indians had a tendency to sort of charge out of the gates in April and then just kind of wither away in August. And so fans were sort of shielding themselves behind boos, to the extent where Bob Feller would later say that he wished all their games were on the road because he felt like the road fans were easier on them than the home fans. And so they didn't want to get sort of their hopes up only to have their hearts ripped out. But they were turning out at extraordinary numbers. I mean, 75,000, 80,000 fans to these games. It wasn't like they were disbelieving. They were just kind of shielding themselves. But at the same time, it was kind of undeniable to note that, like, everything that was happening in that year was coming up roses. And, like, it just seemed like everything Bill Veeck was doing, from, you know, shifting Larry Doby into the outfield to trading for Gene Bearden to signing Satchel Paige, which was a tremendously risky move that ended up, you know, working out so well. Hank Greenberg later said that Bill Veeck, who was a man who was losing his hair at this point, used to sort of like squirm his fingers through his hair and little strands would fall out, and he'd pick them up and he'd be like, it's growing back. It's growing back. It just kind of felt like everything was coming up roses that year. And so there was this sense that somehow, that even though the Indians kind of had a swoon there at the end, it was going to come back. They were going to win. And so by the time they got to the World Series, everybody picked the Indians to win. They were a team of destiny.
Veeck, well, I'll close this before I talk to you about the process of the book a little bit. Veeck is such a fascinating character, and he's thought of, I think, as you kind of point out, because of the Brown stuff and the White Sox stuff later on. He's thought as like this almost like clown print. Like Bill Murray is always rumored to be playing him in this theoretical movie that I'm assuming is never going to happen. But like Bill Veeck is just this character, but like this is. Like, he's a champion here. This is like a Theo Epstein of these guys. There's something about him that I think it gets forgotten because he would do all these kind of promotional things, and his family obviously as well, that like it's forgotten. Like, this was like a pretty great baseball mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've seen a lot of people say this and talk about this. They refer to Bill Veeck as sort of the P.T. Barnum of baseball, and I think that that's a real disservice to his legacy. I mean, the sort of idea that P.T. Barnum had, that a sucker is born every second, is just not how Veeck thought about it. He just really thought that sort of the bread and circuses that he was offering could coexist with the competitive play on the field. But if you took away the competitive play, the bread and circuses wouldn't work. And I think that you almost saw this with his Browns tenure. He couldn't sort of replicate the attendance numbers that he had in Cleveland. And so he really did believe that the entertainment was good to sort of keep fans coming out and entertain and stuff like that. But if you didn't give them a good product, they were going to sour on you and assume you were just doing this for cynical reasons. And so he was a really sound baseball man who came into Cleveland in 1946, and the Indians are a sixth place team. And he builds them into a championship contender within 2 years. And by building, it wasn't, I mean, if Veeck hadn't bought that team, the Indians wouldn't have won the World Series that year. I mean, there's just no question about it. Veeck literally built that team. He did all these incredible trades. He integrated the team. He approved things like Bob Lemon turning into a pitcher. He was an extremely sound baseball man, and that has been the thing that people are overlooking.
Okay, let's talk about the process of this book. How much did you have? One thing that I did differently with my book, How Lucky, which is out in a week and a half, one thing I did differently with my book is. With this and the other one, this is the first time I wrote the whole thing and then tried to sell it. And I hadn't done that before. What was your process on this? When did you start trying to put this thing out to find someone that would publish it?
I didn't have a lot. I want to tell a quick story that involves you here. When I was first thinking about writing a book, I went to an event that Chad Harbuck and you were doing in Brooklyn for a book called Pitching in the Pinch by Christy Mathewson. And Chad Harbuck had been my very first editor ever. He accepted a piece that eventually got into M+1, and that was the first published piece I ever had. And so I wanted to meet him because we'd only sort of interacted on there. And I'd always sort of be interested in you because you're from Southern Illinois, which I am from as well. And so I went to that event, and I really got interested in Pitching in a Pitch. I bought the book. I ended up pitching a story about it that got picked up by the New Yorker online. From that piece in the New Yorker that came from your event, I got my agent. And my agent read that piece, contacted me, said, "Do you want to write a book?" I said, "Sure." We started talking about Bill Veeck. And it sort of became obvious to me that it would be a very tough thing to sell a book about the Browns. And I didn't think that was really possible. I then was going through the research, found this Indians angle, and went to a friend's house who is a writer. And Noah, who became my editor, was there. I'd never met him before. I knew he was an editor. We were talking. He'd heard through my agent that I was writing a book about baseball, and he asked me what it was. And I explained the sort of Cleveland book to him, and he was just like, "Write up a proposal. I think we've got something there." And so I already had a leg up on the process already from having sort of met him and stuff like that. So yeah, it probably took me like 4 months to write up a proposal based on those four men. But I hadn't done the research yet, and so I didn't know how exciting 1948 was. The original proposal was the book was going to start in 1947, the minute that Larry Doby integrates the Indians, and then sort of go blow by blow through 1947 and 1948. And that is not what the book ended up being.
Yeah, to further our crisscrossing through each other's lives from back in Brooklyn, Noah is now my editor on How Lucky. He is now my editor, and he's over at HarperCollins. I think did he leave in the process of this book?
He did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's happened to me before too. That happened with Army Wedding. I know how it goes. I think that, and I will put it this way: Noah still talks about your book a lot. The people that left did not talk about my book.
Oh no.
So Noah's got your back. Noah's got your back in a way that they never did. But yeah, so I remember doing that event, and I love The Art of Fielding. I think that's a brilliant book, and I think he's a wonderful writer. Yeah. And but I was, you know, I was still just kind of like I had been away from Deadspin for a few years by that point, but I was still kind of Deadspin guy. So I was very, very nervous about like, wow, there's going to be so many smart people and so many literary people, and I'm going to be like, look at pictures of Jay Cutler, and this. I was worried that was going to be the vision that everybody had. So I really loved that.
The thing that I remember you about that event was somebody asked a question like, what players would have been really good playing back in Christy Mathewson's time? And you said Kyle Loesch. And you said Kyle Loesch because you said anybody would have been good back in Christy Mathewson's time. And so you were using Kyle Loesch as an example, and that always stuck with me.
It's true, right? Like the baseball writer Joe Sheehan talks about this all the time, that like, you know, if you were to bring Babe Ruth today and to put him at the plate, he would see like a middling rookie league curveball and would run screaming away from the plate, yelling about witchcraft and all of these like terrible things. So I always find that kind of fascinating. Like the idea that like his argument is like the best baseball player of all time is Mike Trout, and the best pitcher of all time is Jacob DeGrom, because whoever the best person is right now,
they're the best.
is that person? I think it's a good point. By the way, I want to get your story a little bit, because you are from Litchfield. You're about an hour and a half, a little over hour and a half from Mattoon, where I am from. Yeah. My mother's family every year has the Dooley. My mother's maiden name is Dooley. They have the Dooley family reunion in Nokomis. just over Bayou. We do every 3 years. I have to go back every 3 years because my mother's getting older now and she can still host the event. But now she needs more assistance from me to help organize everything. So every 3 years I spend Labor Day in Nokomis for the Dooley family reunion. So I'm back there. My mom is from Mowiqua, which is over by Decatur. So that is our neck of the woods. So we know that very well. I'm curious, what's your story? Like when did you leave our Central Illinois world and get yourself out to New York City?
I went to Washington University in St. Louis for college. I majored in English. And like a lot of people that do that, I had no idea what I was going to do. So I made the choice to pack up two suitcases and move to New York. So I moved here without any contacts, without any job. And I figured that I could sort of make it work for a few months, maybe do some odd jobs and stuff like
that.
When
is this? What year is this?
This is 2000. This is 2 months after 2001.
Okay.
I mean, after September 11, 2001. I think I'd been to New York one time and maybe spent like 2 or 3 days there. And so I lived in a YMCA for a while and then eventually found an apartment in the East Village. And within like, I think 3 months, I got a job at Random House in their managing editorial department. And so I did that for a while. I ended up getting a Fulbright scholarship. I moved to Chile for a while and I lived there and came back and got into a PhD program at Brown University. And So I was going to go the sort of academic route. And I remember one of the professors told me that my writing was too clear and that he said that if you wanted to sort of make it in this world, you needed to study the way that we wrote more, sort of use the language that we wrote more and sort of adapt my writing accordingly. Woof. And that was a real eye-opener for me. And I just kind of realized that I did not want to write like that. And so I dropped out and I thought that I'll just see if I can write on my own. So then I came back to New York.
And here you are. And do you ever get back? Do you ever make it back to?
I go back all the time. My dad
is your family. Your family still there?
Yeah, they're still there. My dad had season tickets to the St. Louis Cardinals forever. And so, we always were going to Cardinal games. I grew up going to Cardinal games all the time. I'm still a diehard Cardinals fan. Go to see them whenever they play the Mets, anytime they come to New York. But my dad was the one who really instilled the love of baseball with us. Like I read David Halberstam's October 1964 just over and over as a kid. I love that sort of book.
How are you? I'm frustrated with this current Cardinals team. They feel like a team that's just going to be bobbing around 500 all year, irritating me.
Yeah, they're a little top heavy. It's not the best team right now. But my dad was at Game 6 of the 2011 World Series. He was at the 7th game of the 1982 World Series. he is a dyed-in-the-wool Cards fan.
Good man, good man. Well, of course, that's all right-minded, good-thinking, good-hearted people are. Okay, the last question I ask everybody is, what was your unboxing like? That moment when your first copy. One thing I've really kind of not gotten across, by the way, about your book is it looks fantastic. By the way, really is like very well designed. It's got a wonderful, wonderful jacket. It's just a solid, really good-looking book. What did that feel like when this is your first book? Feel like when you open this up, you open that box and you get to open all these things up.
This book took me a long time to write. I think I worked on it for 4 years or something like that because I just didn't know what I was doing. It took me a long time to figure out how to write a chapter and how to get the narrative down. And I think the first draft was over 500 pages. So it just took a long time. And so I really didn't know if I was ever going to see that endpoint. And so honestly, whenever I unboxed it, the emotion I felt was relief. Just like, I can't believe this is over. This happened. I'll know better next time. But it was like I just finished my first marathon, even though I hadn't trained for a marathon.
Well, it's a wonderful book. And seriously, congratulations on it. And I'm telling you, man, like, Central Illinois, completely underappreciated nationally
yes.
as a place of making stuff happen.
Such great cuisine, such great baseball. Yeah, it's the best. Yeah.
Listen, hey, listen, I will look up. I will holler at you at the next Dooley family reunion in Nokomis.
Hey, and that sounds great.
There's like the little park downtown. I don't remember the name of the park. At the time when I was a kid, it was the biggest park I'd ever been to in my life. And then I went back a couple of years ago, and I was like, wow, like there's like one sad sunset. And that's part of what happens when you leave us Central Illinois.
That's
go
it, yeah.
Somewhere else. All right, well, congratulations on everything. This book is terrific. The book is Our Team, The Epic Story of Four Men in the World Series That Changed Baseball. Luke, it is an honor to get to chat with you about it. Continue good luck with the book, and go Cardinals.
Thanks, Will. Go Cards.